You're listening to That Jesus Podcast.
Hey guys, it's Titus, and today I am not joined by Drew Latin. I kicked him off the podcast because of his empire-embracing vote that he cast for Joe Jorgensen, and so it was nice knowing him. Just kidding, he'll be back. How else could I lead him toward the light if he wasn't a co-host of this show? So he'll definitely be back, even though he's not part of this intro. In fact, he did pop in and out of the interview that we are featuring today with Dr. Hart, which was a great conversation. And so without any further ado, let's cue that up. Today we're joined by Dr. Drew G.I. Hart. Dr. Hart is an activist, a professor, and the author of Trouble I've Seen, and his most recent one, Who Will Be a Witness? So thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Hart.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So for those of us who aren't very familiar with what you're doing and where you live, could you give us a little information about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I am currently a resident in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. This is the second time that I'm living here in Harrisburg, originally from Philadelphia area, but I am currently the assistant professor of theology in the Biblical and Religious Studies Department at Messiah University. I'm in my fifth year of teaching there at the institution, and prior to that, I kind of have a mixed history of both. Initially, right after I graduated college, undergrad, I was at a multiracial Anabaptist congregation as a youth pastor there here in Harrisburg, and also working in an after-school program in the city for middle school boys. Then I moved back to Philly when I was at my home church and was an assistant professor there. Historically, you know, it was a black congregation there, and connected also much more broadly with Anabaptists, much more broadly at that time, especially in the Philly community, just a really neat Anabaptist community in Philly. And then did my MDiv while I was there, Missio Seminary with an urban concentration, and then did my PhD work at Lutheran Theological Seminary, Philadelphia. And my work was around black theology and Anabaptism and putting them in conversation with one another. And then moved back to Philly, to Harrisburg, where, again, I said I'm teaching, but also attends now a different Anabaptist congregation, another multiracial Anabaptist congregation, Harrisburg First Church of the Brethren. And my role is kind of multifaceted alongside of teaching. I do a lot of anti-racism work with the church, kind of a more theologically grounded way of entering into the conversation, as well as working in the neighborhood. I'm a co-leader for a group called Free Together that kind of brings an ecumenical group of Jesus followers together from across different denominations that want to do some grassroots on the ground work on behalf of our neighbors. And so, yeah, there's just a range of different ways that I'm involved in, obviously writing and, you know, speaking. In fact, these days I've been just so busy with so much in so many different directions, but I'm grateful for just the opportunity to have the opportunity to engage in meaningful ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And you also have a podcast yourself, the Inverse Podcast, right?
Yeah. So, and it's kind of fun because my co-podcaster is Jared McKenna, who's actually from Australia. And so we actually really have a kind of more global conversation that we have going on, because we're literally on opposite ends of the world. while it's scheduling nightmares just to make that work, we actually have a lot of fun together and engage a whole bunch of folks from all around the world and have a pretty global audience as well. So it's a lot of fun.
Nice. So you mentioned that you've done some work at the intersection of the black church and Anabaptism, which is a really interesting topic to me. So could you share a little bit about how you first discovered Anabaptism? I assume you didn't grow up in an Anabaptist church, and how that relates to the black church tradition that you grew up in.
Yeah. So I definitely did not. I had never even heard of it in my until I became an adult. Basically, when I went off to Messiah at that time, college, and entered on campus and found out that it had some Anabaptist origins. I didn't even know what an Anabaptist was, right? Thing like anti-Baptist. You know what do you mean? What you got? You got a problem with us? What's going on? And so, yeah, that was my first introduction even to the tradition at all. I was a biblical studies major, so I actually got to engage with a variety of different Anabaptist scholars in the BRS, Biblical and Religious Studies department. But yeah, I wouldn't have considered myself an Anabaptist while I was there. I would have certainly been starting to wrestle with those issues and questions. But I didn't identify as Anabaptist. Then I went to Harrisburg Brethren in Christ Church, which was a multiracial Anabaptist church. That's where I first became, I was a associate pastor there for youth ministries. And so there I was getting a little bit more delving into some Anabaptist community and, you know, emphases. And in some ways, although it was like, I think the Brethren in Christ is a complicated denomination in terms of Anabaptism, because some congregations aren't really Anabaptist anymore, but certainly this congregation, that was still, you know, an important thread, but it expressed itself in probably a whole variety of different ways because it was a multiracial congregation and kind of fleshing it out in different ways. But it was meaningful for me to kind of see some of these convictions and values get fleshed out in actual community. But the irony is I didn't consider myself an Anabaptist while I was there either. if someone asked me, I wouldn't have called myself an Anabaptist. I would have said, you know, I have some Anabaptist leaning things that I'm wrestling with, but that would have been about it. So when I moved back to Philly to go for seminary and I was back at my home church, one of the things I began to realize was that, you know, I had changed pretty significantly. And it was really in being back home that I was like, oh, dang, man, these Anabaptists got me, I guess, because, you know, it just had influenced me enough. So I actually strangely started first calling myself an Anabaptist when I was no longer a part of an Anabaptist community. And just kind of just wanting to name honestly that had been a part of my formation. Not, and I always call myself a hybrid, right? I am. But that had deeply shaped me in significant ways. And then from there, I actually started connecting with, there's a group in Philly called Kingdom Builders, which is an urban Anabaptist gathering of leaders. And so connecting with them, and it was really beautiful. It's like, you know, you got like third generation Black Mennonites there and Latino Mennonites, Asian Mennonites, White Mennonites, all different Brethren in Christ, you know, Circle Hope crew and all. So it's just a really diverse group of Anabaptists in an urban context collaborating together across very different congregations, right? Demographics, yeah, and goals. And it was just a really beautiful thing. And so even though I wasn't a part of an Anabaptist congregation, that became like a really important space for me. In fact, I'd still continue to consider many of those folks very dear friends. And in the process of just that journey that I had gone on, when I eventually did my PhD work, it was obvious what I wanted to do. I wanted to put these two in conversation, these streams, right? The Black church tradition and Anabaptist tradition in conversation together, precisely because the way I was thinking about it was thinking about two traditions that were born on the underside of Western Christendom and white supremacy. And the way that Anabaptism, you know, born more on the internally within Europe, right? And its implications of wrestling with, you know, what I call Christian supremacy over society and the marriage of the church and state together, how they were working through that and doing so by focusing on the particularity of who Jesus is, right? The story of Jesus as the response to that rather than the abstract spiritualized Jesus that can be morphed into anything. And I also saw that in the Black church tradition, again, it's a community that was born on the underside of white supremacy here in the United States. But white supremacy, it was that, like, what we forget is that was first and foremost a Christian project, a diseased Christian project, but a Christian project nonetheless. And so, you know, you had white Christians saying, you know, God wants you to be slaves and God endorses the slaveholding society and, you know, you'll get your freedom in the sweet by and by. And that's about all they had to offer. And yet you had these enslaved Africans encountering a very different Jesus, a Jesus as a liberator, a Jesus as a co-sufferer, a Jesus that was close by and a friend in hard times, who could help them sustain and survive through the struggles that they were going through. And so they turn to also the particularity of Jesus, right? You think of Luke 4, 18 and 19, where Jesus says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to bring good news to the poor, release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Like, they saw Moses being fulfilled in the person of Jesus. And so it was in the particularity of Jesus once again, in different ways, right? Different emphases in each tradition, although some overlapping as well, but different emphases, one more focusing on the peacemaking of Jesus, one on the liberating work of Jesus, I mean, of God. But I think that both of them were pushing against a kind of abstract Jesus and abstract God that could be used to endorse the status quo, right, and to do harm and violence to others. And so I thought that there was a lot of synergy there, stuff to that could come together, stuff for good tension and conversation, as well as just learning from different traditions that were born on the underside of so much of failed Christianity in terms of a diseased, mangled Christianity that had gone on in the West for centuries.
Yeah, and I think both sides of that are so important because we Anabaptists, at least modern Anabaptists, can focus so much on the peace teachings that we don't actually do anything. And yet if you're focusing only on deliverance from injustice, you can end up doing that in an unpeaceful way. So I can see how those two traditions could be very mutually beneficial for sure.
Can you break down in a really simple way the core elements, the core distinctives you see between Anabaptist Christianity, that tradition, and the Black Christian tradition? I know that's kind of basic. A lot of our audience are coming from an Anabaptist tradition, but they're kind of like a fish in water trying to figure out how water is wet.
Yeah. I think number one, even the phrase, like, so I used to have a blog called Taking Jesus Seriously. And that's a phrase that I saw show up in both Black theological work and Anabaptist work, right? Taking Jesus seriously. And I just thought, I mean, that's just a fascinating starting point. So I think that is one of the concerns that many Anabaptists and many certainly in the Black church have a concern around is what does it mean to take Jesus seriously? Again, I do think there are different emphases around what people are emphasizing when they say that. But I do think that both of them have that as a goal in some way to push against the kind of abstract, domesticated Jesus. Another thing I would say that often those traditions tend to be much more praxis oriented, right, than other broader Western Christianity is just more about the intellect and the mind and, you know, getting all your doctrine right. And so it's just about orthodoxy and no orthopraxy there. And so I think that that's another way in which we can see some overlap in terms of how we live into the way of Jesus actually matters. And then we could go further in terms of, and this is more, some of what I draw from Anabaptist tradition isn't always contemporary Anabaptism, but it's also its earliest movement, like thinking about the 16th century movement, like there was actually deep synergy of the 16th century Anabaptists with the poor peasants' rebellions that were taking place at that time. And so there's a lot of concerns and critiques that are shared between the Anabaptists and the poor peasants. And while overall you could say that the Anabaptists take a different response, although not all did in the 16th century, but certainly overall, like that's the turn that they made. I think to not lose sight of that there's a certain synergy with the poor people's campaign that ought not to be lost. And I think that, again, and you could actually say the same thing about the Black church is very complicated right now, but certainly its synergy certainly was with, you know, whether it be enslaved Black people or poor black working class people struggling against, you know, Jim Crow and all that. And even so, even as I critique maybe contemporary Anabaptists, I could also critique some aspects and portions of the Black church itself that I think has also lost sight of some of those emphases. But anyway, those are some of the things that I think. And so then the ethics, right? I mean, when I talk about like, so I think peace and peacemaking and liberation and justice, like those are like if you read carefully, sometimes depending on the work that you're reading, what theologian you're reading, like they could be critiquing the exact same thing, just using different language, right? So while like one theologian might, you know, be critiquing the systemic violence and coercion, right, and maybe an more Anabaptist side of things, while the systemic violence and oppression, systemic oppression and injustice, and they might actually be critiquing some of the exact same things, just using a different theological language of ethic of peace versus, you know, liberation as the means for getting there. So I think that sometimes there's even more similarity. Depending, again, it depends on the theologian, but there can be much more synergy than we might even expect, even with those different kind of frames that people enter into it from their different traditions.
So in your book, Who Will Be a Witness, you mentioned two formative chapel experiences that you had in seminary. Do you mind sharing those with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I was in college between 2000 and 2004. And so the most pivotal experience while I was there was certainly 9/11. And in the aftermath of that, you know, college trying to engage us as, you know, war was brewing and or not brewing, had begun already, and revenge was in the air, and it was had really soaked and immersed into kind of the spirit of so many Christians as well, American Christians. And so on one particular occasion, we were in chapel, large chapel, main chapel, and you can imagine darkened auditorium, and we've got the speaker, and at that time I had never heard of him. His name was John Deere, a Catholic priest at the time, and he was speaking. He was speaking on, you know, Matthew's Sermon on the Mount and Matthew 5-7, different themes there around, like, you know, blessed are the peacemakers and love your enemies and turn the cheek and all these different things, and you know, challenging the way that we understand who Jesus was. And then he began to connect that to what was going on in our society and the ways that, you know, we were seeking revenge and being hateful and warmongering. And I mean, he got very specific in terms of like George Bush and the war and all. Like, he just went there. And I didn't grow up, like I already said, I didn't grow up in a peace church tradition. So, you know, I'm like, oh, like he's really going there today, right? He's not holding back. So this is interesting. So, but what was interesting to me was that it was all like a Jesus-centered message. Like that was, everything was grounded in the teachings of Jesus. And so the one thing that I did have was my church that I was raised in taught us to lean into Jesus and to keep Jesus at the center of our faith. And so I began to lean into his message, really wanting to hear what he had to say. And the more I leaned in, the more I realized all of a sudden that there's like this commotion that's beginning to build in the auditorium. Mm. And I'm hearing movement. I'm looking around. All before I know it, there's like almost like a stampede of students like marching out and leaving the auditorium altogether. Hundreds. I mean, I'm not talking about like a trickle. I'm talking about like a completely disruptive moment where hundreds of students got up and left while he was speaking. And I always say, if at most Christian colleges, you have to get like college like credit for attendance. So you got to like swipe your card. The fact that they left before swiping their card meant that they were very serious. And so it was just fascinating, you know, and I was just confused. I was like, all right, I get that he was stepping on some toes and maybe this wasn't a message that we were all used to. I had one of my brothers who were actually at that time in the military. In my early years of college. And so like, I get maybe some discomfort and stuff, but like this was rooted in a Jesus, like literally the teachings of Jesus, his words. So at the very least, even if we were uncomfortable, I couldn't understand why people at least wouldn't just try to listen and hear and receive the message, like why they just couldn't even entertain the thought at any point. And so one of the things I began thinking about after that experience was just the ways that so many of my peers had been formed and socialized in such a way that literally their Americanness was preeminent over their faith in Christ, so their identity, their baptism in Jesus, right? And so it was just a really fascinating way to see how they clung to their Americanness more than they clung to Jesus in that moment. And again, it doesn't mean necessarily that that they would have to have agreed with that per se, right? They could have struggled, but to even just listen and wrestle with the teachings of Jesus and what it might mean for us for today, that they wouldn't even entertain that was telling for me. And then I had another experience. The other one was a much smaller. We had these alternative chapels on Thursdays where you could kind of pick. So there's like a bunch of different options, and a lot of them are student run options. And so there was a chapel at the time, it's kind of silly now, but it was called Culture Shock, but it was run by students of color on campus, especially Black and Brown students on campus. And, you know, just a space where many students of color felt like, you know, a space for them to kind of worship God in ways that were more familiar to us in our own traditions that weren't provided often throughout the broader campus experience. And so this particular day we went there, and we had a guest speaker there as well. And I actually don't remember his name, but a young, probably my age now, so I'll call him Young. but this young Black man who was speaking, and he was kind of walking through biblical history, right? Thinking about God as someone that had taken sides with the oppressed and delivered the Israelites out of Egypt, and challenged the monarchy of Israel with the prophets and told them to, you know, do justice, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like ever-flowing streams, and how that culminated in the person of Jesus Christ, who, as I said, right, preached good news to the poor and to let the oppressed go free, and actually lived in solidarity with the least, last, and lost in his society in really powerful ways. And we see that, yeah, throughout the whole gospel story. And so he culminated all of that, you know, climax and with the person of Jesus and who he was and what he meant. But then he again also turned to American history and the ways that the church, and he was explicit and said the white church, had failed to live into that, right? Had failed to practice that. And so he talked about the history of white supremacy and the genocide of indigenous people for centuries, the centuries of enslavement that went on that didn't end until 1865, followed by a new season of, you know, black codes and Jim Crow and convict leasing and chain gangs and, you know, lynching of black people and all the violence that went on after that, and even to the more present times in terms of mass incarceration and the war on drugs and all these different issues that have impacted black communities. And he basically just, I mean, he called out the hypocrisy of the way of Jesus in terms of God's taking care of and siding with the poor and oppressed, and the way that the white American church had perpetuated and participated in the oppression of black people in particular, and people of color more broadly in this nation. And so it was just a really powerful critique that he was offering. Now, as I often say, like, I did grow up in a black church, so it wasn't necessarily strange to hear a, you know, people in the church talk about racism and think about it from a matter of their faith. But he did go, I mean, his critique was much more poignant than anything that I had heard growing up. And like, he went in all the way. So again, I was just kind of leaning in, just really wanting to hear everything that he had to say, how he kind of told the biblical story in a really powerful way was just really gripped me, as well as just the way that he just connected it to our history and all the contemporary issues that were happening in our society. Now, this chapel was majority students of color were there, but there were also white students of, that were in the audience as well. And what was fascinating was that as he was talking partway through, as I'm leaning in, I noticed all of a sudden again that many, not all, but many of the white students began getting up and leaving. And it was just fascinating. And I think it was because he used the word white, right? He, as a descriptor, talk about the white church and white supremacy and the things, the failures of Christianity that had been whitened and all that stuff, and Jesus and all that kind of stuff. And I think that it was uncomfortable for my peers to hear that. And so even though he had a really powerful reading of scripture culminating in the person of Jesus and thinking about Jesus's meaning for us today and thinking about historical facts. I mean, these are just things that happen. It's not like, you know, their opinion. This is historical facts. And yet, because of the discomfort, what I saw and what I interpreted from them getting up was that they were clinging more to their whiteness than they were, again, to Jesus and the challenging message that Jesus offers for us. And so I think both of those stories together just really helped me think about our formation and our socialization, and nobody likes to think that they've been formed by anything, or we're just free agents. But no, everyone is socialized, right? But to what degree have we allowed our discipleship to disrupt how we've been socialized in the world, our assumptions, our frames, our lenses that we see the world through? And so both our American identity, nationalism, right, as well as race and whiteness and white supremacy and how those things can really shape and grip one's identity. We have to be very aware of that, especially if when they begin to override our commitments to the preeminence of Jesus Christ in our lives.
Yeah. That's really unfortunate. I mean, this is a seminary where people are studying the scriptures, and I would say that, like, Jesus talked more about the kingdom than anything else, and you know, whether it's in the Sermon on the Mount talking about loving your enemies or even dying for his enemies on the cross, peace was one of his most important teachings. So to have people walking out when their American identity and their warmongering is being challenged, and then Paul comes along and talks about, you know, Jew and Gentile relations, like that was a probably his primary concern in a lot of his letters. Yep. And so when they walk out when some of their white identity is challenged and some of the sins of their ancestors, and even currently the, you know, seminary students who should be studying these texts
as undergrad students, majority of the students on campus are not doing biblical and religious studies. So the majority of them are, you know, engineering and nursing, and they're not necessarily, so they might take, you know, one, or I think everyone at that time probably had to take two Bible classes and one theology class, but the majority, that's not why they're there really. So most students were not like me. I was a biblical studies major, but that was only a fraction of the students. And so they, I think, already had preconceptions of what Christianity was, and it was already conflated with Americanness even before they got to campus. Mm-hmm. And they didn't take enough courses probably to disrupt that. Yeah.
I guess it just goes to show that Jesus' teachings and Paul's teachings are just as disruptive and radical in 21st century as they were in the first few centuries.
Yep, absolutely.
So I really enjoyed the chapter in Who Will Be a Witness, where you give us a fresh perspective on the biblical figure of Barabbas. So could you share some of the common misconceptions we have about Barabbas, and, you know, really what the authors of the Gospels were actually trying to communicate through those stories about him?
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating the way that people still perceive Barabbas. In fact, I still like to, before I start telling people about, you know, my reading of it, I like to just see what people think. And they still, you know, tend to have this view of Barabbas as this just really bad, mean, evil person, serial killer, just murderer for no reason kind of figure, right? And then you look in popular culture, sometimes he's like cockeyed and drooling in the, out of the mouth. And like, you know, there's even a scene, there's one movie where Barabbas is like laughing uncontrollably, like he's just like this evil madman, you know, like ha, 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 you know, just strange stuff that the, so it's really denigrate the image of Barabbas in a lot of those. But then there's also what I call a more sophisticated way that people use Barabbas, but still not based in scripture, but it is more theologically grounded. Like they're trying to use Barabbas to kind of as a metaphor and analogy for penal substitutionary atonement, right? And so Jesus is the sinless sacrifice, and he takes Barabbas's place, right? And kind of like, you know, we all are Barabbas, right? And Jesus takes his place and he takes our place, right? That kind of way of using that story. But what's fascinating is when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, none of them have any of that to say about Barabbas. That's not what they're focused on at all. That's not the concern. And Barabbas is not just a random murderer. He's not just an evil person. He's not, you know, any of those things. Instead, they're actually very consistent about who Barabbas is. All of them point to the fact that he was an insurrectionist, that he participated in the uprisings, right? Some will say he was a bandit, which was in the first century basically means a revolutionary, right? Someone who, a kind of revolutionary figure. And so if that's the case, if all of them are consistent about that, then why have we misconstrued Barabbas so much, I think is one question to ask. And secondly, maybe the more important question is, why does Barabbas show up in every single gospel story at the climax of the Jesus story? What does it have to offer us? What do we have to learn from Barabbas? And how does rethinking Barabbas help us see something more about who Jesus is as well, right? That's for me the interest. And so, obviously in my chapter I get into history, and I won't get into all of that now, but I think what we can see is that Barabbas is solely being described in socio-political terms, and Jesus is being compared to him. And obviously in the scenario, like in Matthew, actually, he's the only one that actually doesn't use the word insurrectionist, but just says he's a notorious prisoner, assuming that everyone knows. But then what it does do is it goes into this more lengthy comparison of Jesus and Barabbas, where in the oldest manuscripts, it actually says, you know, who do you want, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus the Christ? You know, like who are you going to pick? And when you think about the word Jesus, like what it means, Joshua, Yeshua, the one who saves, your liberator, your deliverer, right? Who are you looking for liberation? And so it's a really powerful way of reframing and helping us wrestle with, you know, what are we looking for in our liberator? What kind of liberation are we looking for? What do we think will actually work, right, in the world? And here the mistake could be, someone could mistakenly, and this is what many Western Christians have done, is to say Barabbas is about an earthly kingdom and Jesus is about a spiritual kingdom. But that goes directly against Jesus' own teachings, right? You pray on that my kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven, right? It's a very earthly. Yes. Jesus cared about the poor and fed them, and those who were stigmatized in this world, and the Samaritans and vulnerable women and all these things going on in society. And so it's not just an earthly versus spiritual kingdom. There's something else going on, right? And so the real question, and I think one of the clues, like looking at verses like, you know, in Luke 19, where Jesus approaches Jerusalem and laments over it and mourns, right? Oh, Jerusalem, if only you had known the things that make for peace, right? And the question is, in that text, like it's anticipating the Jewish-Roman war and how the Romans are going to destroy Jerusalem and slaughter those inside the city. I mean, we know historically like 6,000 Jews are crucified, many more than that are killed and slaughtered. It's just horrific violence, right? And so the thing for Jesus is, the things that make, there's actual things that make for shalom, right? Mm-hmm. For the God's dream for us. There is a path towards that. Jesus actually does want that, just like Barabbas wants shalom. But what are the things that make for shalom? How do we actually get there? And so it's an invitation to actually take up the way of Jesus, to actually take Jesus seriously. Let's take that language again, right? That Jesus's peacemaking and enemy love actually are realistic, real, faithful ways to actually engage the injustice and oppression that we see in our world today. And so that I think we're missing. And then on top of it, just to, you know, push, I wanted to stretch even my Anabaptist friends and stuff that, you know, this, that some of the challenge then is also that Jesus enters into this himself in body. He's not just on the sidelines critiquing the way that oppressed people deal with their violence. He's embodying this thing. He's participating in it. And he's empathetically responding to what's going to happen because of those who are engaging. He's not just condemning them kind of like this self-righteous, like, you know, he's actually empathetic. It's a lament. But he embodies and participates rather than just judging from the sidelines. So it's actually an invitation that real peacemaking is participatory, right? It's not just a spectator sport. And so, yeah, I think that there's a lot of challenges that we can think about when we think about this comparison of when we begin to liberate Barabbas, we begin to liberate the way that Jesus gets used as a mascot for the status quo and invites us to take up our cross and follow him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And we've touched on this already a little bit, but could you give us like a really quick historical sketch of how white supremacy, colonialism, and Christendom have collectively distorted the church's countercultural witness?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give a shorthand of what I do in the book, which is to, I mean, I think so. If many, I'm assuming that there's probably a lot of Anabaptist listeners that many we'll be familiar with just the critique, the Constantinian critique, right? That is, you know, the early church, the first 300 years of the church did not have power, political power, social power. I mean, and you could argue around the third century, it begins to grow a little bit more influential in some ways, but still, they still get persecuted at times, and they don't have the kind of power to make things happen. They don't expect political power, and their church on the margins, right? But then after Constantine comes, you know, you see, well, number one, he privileges and advantages the church, and especially the bishops in particular, and basilicas and money and tax exemptions and war exempt, all kinds of stuff is happening, and people are flooding into the church in unbelievable numbers, and there's adaptions to even like the catechism process to deal with the number, all kinds of stuff is going on during that time, and the church is moving from the margins to the center. And then in 100 years, under Theodosius, it becomes the official religion of the land. And then before you know it, it's just like this. I mean, it takes centuries before it fully gets to what we think of in the most classic sense of Christendom. But by 1000 AD, you know, you have this like massive like Christian supremacy over all of society that has been formed that many people will now call Christendom. And sometimes people use the language of Constantinian Christianity and all of that. That marginalized, you know, the life and teachings and the way of Jesus, and somehow, you know, propped up monarchy and all these other things and coercive Christianity and the violence justifying, you know, war and violence of other people. All these things happen in that time period. But Anabaptists sometimes stop right there. I want to keep the story going, right? And it's at that point that we see, you know, a papal bull is written, Terra Nullius, and during the Crusades, and basically it's like saying empty land. That's what it means. But what they were talking about wasn't empty land. They were talking about you can go and seize and conquest lands that are empty lands, which just meant non-Christian lands. And so you're seeing a justification already for the conquest of other people's lands that they had been on. And so theological work is happening at that point. You jump a few centuries further into the 15th century, you have Portugal who begins enslaving African people. And then right just a few years after that, the church again writes another papal bull giving permission, right, for folks to engage in slavery and conquest and to reduce to perpetual slavery and to take, you know, steal their goods, plunder their goods and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's kind of scary, the theological work that's being done, that's giving permission to this. And like it's the work already started, and then the church, you know, does the theological work to support it. And then of course Spain gets involved and other European nations get involved. And we have the global history that we do now of colonialism and conquest and slavery. And then in the midst of all of that that's happening, white supremacy gets birthed, right? Literally out of Christian supremacy over society, white supremacy is just a diseased version of that. In the earliest writings, you look in like, you know, 1700 and stuff, like the word white and the word Christian were used simultaneously. They meant the same thing to most people. And so this idea of whiteness is being constructed and emerging in the context of colonialism as a justification for hierarchy, for racial hierarchy, for white supremacy over others. And white supremacy, I guess you could say, eventually takes on a life of its own. So it's not just a matter of the church anymore, but it was first and foremost a theological distortion before it was a sociological problem. And so all of that, I mean, the church, we've got to grapple with the ways that so many in the church still want to pursue Christian supremacy over society. And so much of the church is still in various ways enticed by white supremacy. And I think that we've got a lot of work to do to wrestle with exercising these demons, so to speak, in the life of the church, that we can recapture the radical way of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, amen. So I come from a more conservative Anabaptist background, where we were taught to, and once again, I'm not recording. Oh, no, it's still recording. Yeah. Good. All right, let's start that question over. I'll edit this out. So I come from a pretty conservative Anabaptist background where we were taught to eschew the political process because we were taught about, you know, two kingdoms and the kingdom of this world being evil. And so we just don't get involved in those things. And even though I'm not really in such a conservative background or conservative setting anymore, I'm still fairly hesitant of the political process as, you know, a way to address some of these problems that you've been talking about, primarily because from my vantage point, any legislation will always be enforced through the threat of violence. You know, if we don't obey the law, then the police will, you know, get involved and perhaps even use lethal force if people don't cooperate, and certainly use coercion. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about that and how you reconcile engaging politically with some of those Anabaptist leanings.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, number one, I'd say there's good reason to be suspicious of our political process because it is problematic, right? But I would say that the whole existence, I mean, I would say to live in the United States is already to be complicit in the violence and the threat of violence that America lives by. I mean, the nation state exists out of military power, right? There's already military violence happening just to sustain the Americans, the existence of the United States. That most, and especially if people live in white, majority white communities, I would say that policing primarily is used as a suppression of people of color and poor people in this country. So I guess what I'm saying is there's already the complicity and stuff. And then to complicate it, like, we don't live in the same kind of social arrangement as the first century did. We don't live under just a complete pure empire or dictator, authoritarian kind of framework. Like, we live in at least a supposedly democratic republic society, right? How democratic and how republican that's in fact is being tested right now. But but I do think, so the question is, how do we make sense of what it means to be faithful within this context, within the messiness of all the violence that's already in play, but also the, and this, I admit, like, I actually call it in the book, I say, you know, everyone, regardless of whether they vote or not, we all participate in Caesaring, right? And that's the language I use. Now, of course, someone might say, well, that's horrible. We should not participate in Caesaring. But I actually think what is interesting about, and I do think there's something meaningful about thinking about the idea that it is actually undoing Caesaring in some ways also, right? It's actually dispersing power to more people and not concentrated just top-down power. And so it's precisely on those terms that I think there's something actually meaningful about the kind of engagement that we can engage in without lording over others and having participating, allowing more people to have voice in what's happening and more influence in what's happening in our society outside of just a few individuals kind of imposing coarsely their thoughts on others. So yeah, I mean, I think that is my starting point for thinking about it. And then for me, politics is first and foremost, in the most broadest sense, like how I talk about it, is not partisan politics. I think that that's problematic for that to be the grid and framework that we're operating out of, which I think we can see clearly throughout the church, partisan platforms have replaced Christian ethics, right? And people don't even know the difference anymore because it's been like that for so long that everyone thinks that their platform is just organic Christian ethics. But politics is about the polis, the how we organize our society and caring about how it impacts people. I think that Jesus clearly cares about the impact that his society, how it's organized and how it impacts different people. And even his approach to Jerusalem, which is not just a religious center, but it's also the political and economic and social and cultural center, right? That he enters in it and he clashes with it. That's political. That is political, right? So Jesus is actually very invested in politics, just not he's not supporting the Herodian party or the any zealot, you know, group or whatever. But he is invested in politics and how the world is organized because it clashes with the reign of God on this earth. And I think that that's the kind of starting point for us thinking about the complexity of thinking, how do we engage, you know, again, this democratic republic, which we don't have clear biblical directions for how to engage, but we do have clues in terms of we don't want to lord over others, right? We don't want to fall into the temptation that Jesus, Satan tries to tempt Jesus with, right? That those are clues, but beyond that, there is no explicit roadmap, and so we've got to, you know, try to think about how can we engage faithfully, but also recognizing, and this is at least my thinking, you know, is that whether I vote or not doesn't make me unpolitical. In some ways, not voting is a political stance in this, mm-hmm. and it does also have weight to it, right? Now that it doesn't mean it's a legitimate response, but I do think it means that, you know, like everything has implications, and if we support or denounce or resist or whatever, all of those have impact in terms of our society because we are a democratic republic. And so that's the messiness of it. And that's why I do this weird thing in the book of grappling with the option of not voting and taking that seriously, even though I do vote, right? So I'll put that out there. I do vote. But I actually, I mean, in a really significant way, I allow my friend Nikisha, who's another Black Anabaptist, actually, who to kind of offer kind of wrestling with this in a very serious way, because she opts not to, right? And I actually have deep respect for her in, because she doesn't see herself as opting out of politics. She mm-hmm. opts out of the structure of how it's set up and engages still on the grassroots probably more than most people do, right? And for me, my starting point still is grassroots. But then how can I engage the broader electoral system in a way that doesn't allow the tail to wag the dog, right, so to speak, and allow us in our life to be rooted in God's reign and what God is doing in the world and participating in that as the foremost expression of our political response as followers of Jesus.
Yeah. So what are some of those grassroots things that we can do? Let's get practical here. We've been talking about a lot of ideas, and if someone's listening to this and they're encouraged and challenged and want to actually make a difference for the marginalized, what are some very practical steps that all of us can take?
Yeah, so some of the stuff that I suggest in the book, number one is thinking first and foremost about nonviolence, nonviolent resistance, right? I mean, there's just a really powerful, and this you think about the Black church tradition here in the United States. I often say that I wrestle more theologically with Anabaptists, develop a theology of peacemaking, but when I actually want to see what that means and looks like, I look to the Black church, right? Because the Black church has actually embodied that, I think, more faithfully to imagine how to engage in nonviolent resistance and action in the world. So thinking about, you know, especially Dr. King has been deeply important for me to think through what that means. And so there's opportunities for us to, in the way of Jesus, who invites us to love our enemies, to, you know, to take up our cross and follow him, to think about ways that we can actually engage in a way that is as conducive to Jesus's peacemaking as possible, which I think nonviolence as a strategy is, right? It's taking that and kind of putting a strategy for social change in place in light of that. And so that's one way. I think that on the ground work in terms of protest movements and organizing are also really fascinating. Both of them allow us to engage first and foremost on the ground, connected to actual people and neighbors, and stay attuned to where suffering is disproportionate, right? And allow that to be our starting point rather than platforms that some elite person has packaged together and tells us to support. And so protest movements, you know, they're obviously, they often don't last very long, right? They come and they go. But there is an opportunity to be attentive to the moments in ways that we can challenge when there's mass movements for change. Again, when I talk about the Anabaptists having synergy with the poor peasants' rebellion, right? There's something there connected and happening, and they're in the midst of this poor peasant rebellion. They're tending to the presence of Jesus in their community, right? And what that means for them to have and build community together in the midst of that. And I think that that's powerful, and the church should be attentive to what's Jesus up to in the moment, especially during these poor peasant rebellions, movements and stuff that are happening, and how. What might be some ways that we can participate in what God is doing and faithfully? But I actually think that organizing is actually really conducive strategy for local churches. It's grassroots work. It's about going and connecting with your neighbors, hearing their story, letting them share where things hurt, where suffering is disproportionate, where the pain is, right? And taking that seriously, gathering people together, collaborating with neighbors. And this is just a great way to love your neighbor, as Jesus calls us to, and to do it in the public square. And again, and this goes back to the whole challenging the lording over others. What is fascinating about community organizing, it's about dispersed power, right? Giving voice to as many people as possible and coming to the powers that be with a prophetic voice and saying, these are the issues. You're not going to tell us what the issues are. We're telling you what the issues are, right? And so it goes in the opposite direction. And I think that, I mean, that reminds me that Jesus, you know, sets his eyes toward Jerusalem and Luke and heads towards it and tells them, you know, you devour widows' homes, right? You know, and I think that that's kind of a more faithful way, I think, for the church to think about if we are going to be talking to the powers that be, so to speak, that organizing prevents a really good model for us to do it at the grassroots level that's attentive to pain and suffering, to those on the margins of our society, and how to love them well as we're called to love our neighbors. Yeah.
So one more question before we let you go here. Unfortunately, you are kind of an anomaly as a Black Anabaptist. We're very white. Well, we came out of Europe, so but we also haven't been the greatest at engaging other cultures. So what are some things that majority white churches, whether they're Anabaptists or not, can do to, you know, change our environments, our spiritual practices to make it more of a welcoming atmosphere for African Americans and other non-white Christians?
Yeah. And first, let me just say, you know, I think sometimes Anabaptists don't give themselves enough credit. And I know it's complicated, but, you know, the Mennonite Church USA is 20% non-white, and it might actually be higher than that now. That was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably the growing part of the Mennonite Church, right? In the United States. And then globally, Anabaptists are majority people of color. Yep. And so even in the Anabaptist tradition, there actually are some really great examples to look to. I mean, there are third generation African American Mennonite congregations, right, in Philly, and second and third generation Latino communities in Texas, and, you know, like, it just there's really interesting stuff that I think that people can turn to. There was a couple in the mid 20th century, the Larks, who African American couple who became Mennonite, and they did a whole bunch of church planting, either planting Black Mennonite congregations or interracial Mennonite congregations. And I think that that vision was actually very bold at the time. It's on the heels of Harold Bender's The Anabaptist Vision that they are doing all that work. And so they saw, I'd say, a fuller meaning of Anabaptism than most white Anabaptists could see themselves, right? And I think that's often what's been the case, is that many from outside of the tradition sometimes see how it can extend even beyond itself in ways that sometimes those born into it don't even see the implications of some of this stuff. And so that would be one thing, is to lean into the eyes of others, right, and what they can bring, that people bring gifts with them. And that we have to, I think the danger in Anabaptist traditions, but all most of the mainstream Western Christian traditions, is everyone sees their own tradition as like, we've got all the answers, we're the gift to the world, right? And everyone should be glad to become like us, right? And that posture is dangerous. It could be idolatrous at times if we're not careful, and it prevents us from actually receiving gifts from others as well. And so I think that that would be just that posture of learn, of seeking to receive, right? Not just to be teachers, but to also be students is a good posture to take on. And then I think that practically, you know, I think that we've got to look at, you know, who in our church, where's the decision-making power? Do we share that? Who's invited into leadership? What expectations do we impose on leadership? Or is it strictly, like, sometimes we don't realize how cultural our perception of what good leadership is, right? And so we have, like, very influenced by our own culture. We tie our cultural preferences and make it a moral or ethical thing when it's just cultural differences. And so we've got to have a kind of cultural intelligence to see some issues are moral and ethical, but there are other things that are just culturally different, right? And how do we make sense and make space for folks that are just culturally different to bring their gifts in and to make room for that? I think that we've got to interrogate our theology. Again, if it has been shaped by the history of Christendom and colonialism, then it's not just good enough in our society to say, oh, yeah, slavery's bad. Oh, that's great. That's very courageous in 2020, right? but we've got to do more, which is what are the theologies that either permitted, bolstered, or even just were silent to, you know, Jim Crow and all these other forms of thing? Because those things sometimes can stay on alive, the theology itself and the assumptions of the faith, even after we've condemned the outworking of it, of what happens, right? So I think that those are things that we've got to do. I think that it's important for Western enlightened versions of Christianity to decentralize itself and to make a broader space. I mean, so I give the example in the book of, you know, I say, imagine me standing on a table and we gather weekly, you know, and everyone comes and it's just the way that we always gather. I stand on a table, everyone else sits around the edge of the table. And then finally, one week, people say, hey, Drew, why don't you sit down like the rest of us? And I'm like, you know, why? I don't understand. I thought that things were working just fine this way, right, with me standing on the table. I've tried to be benevolent. I've tried to steward my power responsibly in care and in insight, attentive to others. What's the problem? Why are you picking on me, right? And I might go as far to say, you picking on me and pointing this out, you're trying to marginalize me. And I think that sometimes is the way that people respond to challenges of, you know, when they're at the center and there needs to be some shifts and changes going on because it's personal, right? It feels personal. And so it's like, stop marginalizing me. But the challenge would be is at that point for someone to say, hey, Drew, no one's marginalizing you. They're decentralizing you, right? They're inviting you to sit around the table with everyone else, right? Where you've been at the center for so long, there's space for others and for everyone's voice. As certainly in the Anabaptist tradition, you know, this really actual belief in the priesthood of believers, that God can speak through all of us, right? What does that mean to embrace that really, even from an intercultural standpoint, even from the diversity of the church, the global church, the historic church, the church in the United States, to make space for the voices and traditions and gifts of others in our communities, rather than just holding them up as, you know, permanent fixtures that can be idolatrous when we refuse to allow God to work through other people in our midst, right? So I think that there's just great opportunities to actually practice what we believe, that Jesus is preeminent, that Jesus is the center, none of us are, that our traditions also are just mere servants and vehicles that are supposed to point us to Jesus, but they always need radical reformation too, if at any point we find ourselves not yielding fully to the preeminence of Jesus in our lives. And so, and that we can actually sometimes meet and discover Jesus on the margins, on the edges, and those who've been discovering Jesus in the cracks of society, that we're invited to meet Jesus both in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but also in the lives of the crucified of the world, right? And that those are important spaces for us to attend to the delivering presence of Jesus today.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Drew Latin. Do you have any other questions you want to ask before we let Dr. Hart go here?
No, I wish I was had been able to be here for the whole thing, but the bits I heard were really great, and I especially appreciated the practical challenge to kind of deconstruct our cultural assumptions about what's right and good and biblical, and how that can open up so much to those from outside an ethnically Anabaptist tradition, to be willing to deconstruct and maybe recognize the good things of our culture, but also not hold on to it so tightly that it creates barriers. So thanks for sharing that. And I haven't finished your book yet, but I'm looking forward to doing that. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Dr. Hart has another example of someone leaving in the middle of a challenging word when you jumped out of this Skype call. So there you go.
The start of my next book right now.
Good stuff. All right, Dr. Hart, thanks again for joining us, and we'll catch you later.
All right. Thank you. Take care.